I'm hungry.
Me too.
And why is she eating that stuff? She must have picked it up from her trip back home. The smell's making me sick. Don't you think she should eat it somewhere else?
No, that's disrespectful toward Parveen. Actually, I think it's great that we can enjoy different foods.
What would you do if you were this witness? Safe Harbor Respect for All provides diversity workshops across Canada with funding from the Government of Canada. Visit safeharbor.ca. Respect for All. Pass it on.
With the vast amount of changes happening in the world, it's almost impossible to get a clear picture of what's really going on.
We are trapped within the logic of capitalism, leaving us unable to imagine what comes next.
The Extra Environmentalist brings the perspectives of people who can see the whole picture and are ready for whatever comes our way.
Tune in to The Extra Environmentalist every Wednesday from 2 to 3 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM.
This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Welcome to the Extra Environmentalist. Your opposable thumb means nothing.
This is what we want to be. We don't want to be Americans or Germans or English. We want to be extra environmentalists. Always feel wherever you go that you are a stranger. The outsider, the one looking in. This is the viewpoint that makes all places the same to you.
Hello and welcome to The Extra Environmentalist. I'm your host, Seth Moser-Katz, along with my co-host, Justin Ritchie, and you are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR. Hey, Justin, who are we talking to today?
Today, we're speaking with Nicole Foss, and she was in town in early February here in Vancouver, and we recorded an interview with her when she was here, and she runs a site here in Canada called The Automatic Earth, and she has a farm in Ontario, and she writes about energy issues not only from the Canadian perspective, but from a global perspective and how that plays into finance.
Yes, and her message is very well thought out, and she's a very well-educated woman who really knows exactly what she's talking about, very technical-oriented as well.
Yeah, she's the absolute definition of what it means to be an educated person, because I have never met anyone who can take so many different topics, weave them together, and speak about them so intelligently without stuttering, without skipping breath or anything. She just goes at it and will take even the most complex topics and drill them down and make sure that you have the ability to understand them.
What was it like hanging out with her in Vancouver?
Well, it was really cool to hang out with Nicole, because you can just ask her anything. And we talked about what it was like to live on the farm. She moved to Canada from the UK, and she talked about, you know, the challenges in moving to a new place and what it's like to be her kids and what it's like to be her kids when they go to their class and try to give a presentation on peak oil and the teacher and the other students just kind of zone out. It was really fun, a lot of fun.
All right, with no further ado, let's jump right into this episode and hear what Nicole Foss has to say.
Thanks for joining us today, Nicole, from Vancouver, British Columbia, where you are traveling on your continuing world tour on the way out to Hong Kong and Australia. I just wanted to start out in asking, have you been to Australia? Have you been to China before?
No, I've never been to anywhere in Asia or down under. But this time I'm going to be spending a month on the mainland of Australia, a week in Tasmania, a month in New Zealand, and then going to Hong Kong on my way back, and it's just completely taking off. I keep thinking, pinch me, I must be dreaming. I still don't entirely know how this happened, but I'm very pleased that there's interest in such far-flung places.
Do you have any expectations about these places when you're going there? Have you read about them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, Australia, I do expect certain similarities with Canada. They're both in a very large property bubble. The difference, I think, will be that in Canada, there's no sense of limits, really. We've never hit any, not in living memory, if we ever really had to confront genuine limits. In Australia, they have because of the drought. So when you develop a sense of limits in one area, it's not that much of a stretch to extrapolate it to others. So I do think there's a lot more interest in the idea that we might be hitting limits in Australia than I've typically found in Canada. But it is always hard to see a bubble for what it is when you're in it. And so I also expect a certain amount of resistance and justification of why these sky-high property prices are actually reasonable. That's what happens every time. It's different here. We can justify these valuations this time. It's actually never different here, but I'm expecting them to trot out, in places anyway, to trot out arguments like that. Another similarity Canada and Australia have is a lot of the system has been propped up by demand from China. So the Chinese bubble has been feeding commodity demand, which is definitely the business that both Canada and Australia are in the business of supplying. So that common hinge on Chinese demand, I think, is going to be something that will be in common and will be a major factor going forward as the Chinese bubble bursts.
And you're here in Vancouver. You were here about a year ago. And are you noticing any differences in regards to the housing bubble or the economy or anything that stood out to you being back in Vancouver a year later?
Well, I think the housing bubble is going over the edge now. What you get when a housing bubble bursts is not an immediate plummet in house prices. What you get is the liquidity goes out of the real estate market. So what you start to see is a lot more for sale signs. Instead of things flying out of estate agents' windows in a matter of a couple of days, and sometimes for more than the people were asking, instead, things just stop selling. More and more things come on the market so people can pretend to themselves that property is still worth what it once was, but nobody's buying it. And really, what something is worth is only ever what somebody's prepared to pay for it in the real world. So you get this overhang of inventory that builds up. We're at the beginning of that now. Over time, sellers will eventually come down to where the buyers are, and then you'll see this kind of lurching to lower and lower prices as sellers come down, but then the buyers realize that prices are falling, so they offer even less, and you get this ratcheting down over time. And it takes several years for property bubble to really burst. And we're at the very beginning stage of that in Vancouver today.
Well, we did see a property bubble in the United States just a couple of years ago where the price of the property on those houses fell very rapidly. And it was only through a large government spending that we were able to kind of recover out of that a little bit. Are we going to see something similar to that in Canada, that rapid decline? But you said slowly over a couple of years. Are we not going to see that kind of crash that we saw in the United States?
Well, in the United States, it didn't happen overnight either. It began at the end of 2005. And really, the rapid phase was once the system had been unwinding for quite a while already. The end of 2005, beginning of 2006 is when we started to see the inventory build up in the States. And that was the early stage. What we saw more recently that was the more rapid phase was when you started to get all the interest rate readjustments on subprime lending, and you started to get that inventory really weighing very, very heavily on the market, and just tons of foreclosures, which of course pushed the price down even further, partly because when a house is foreclosed on, it's sitting empty, no one's looking after it, it may be stripped of its copper wire, and that lowers the value of everything else around it. So in the States, and the housing bubble there is nowhere near finished bursting, by the way, but in the States, it's been underway for 5 or 6 years already. So it wasn't a particularly rapid process there either. And it still has many years to go to the downside. Now, it does depend to some extent on where you are. If you're in South Florida, then the decline has been much more rapid partly because the overvaluation was that much more extreme. And a lot of places in California as well have experienced quite significant falls. Detroit's already fallen about as far as it's possible to go. There are houses in Detroit you can get for free. You could probably buy up a whole block just for offering to pay a couple of back tax bills. So in some places, the fall has been more dramatic. Sometimes, as in the case of Florida, because the overvaluation was more dramatic. Other times, as in the case of Detroit, because all the industry left and they were well into the process of urban decay. So that could be just bottoming in Detroit already. Other places still have a very, very long way to fall, because at the moment, people can still get mortgages in the States because the public sector backstops mortgages. It backstops pretty much all of them. The private sector is getting out of the game. Because the public sector is backstopping mortgages and providing supposedly ironclad public guarantees, of course, these won't prove to be ironclad at all, but because they're there, it's still propping up prices. That is what they're trying to do, to keep prices high. Now, high house prices are actually not in the interests of most people. And yes, they're in the interests of people who owe a lot of money on a property that would be underwater if house prices fell. But for prices to be ridiculously high actually just forces people into enormous amounts of debt. It forces people to take the debt slavery route. So for society as a whole, it is not a constructive or useful thing at all to prop up house prices. They really need to come down to somewhere sensible so that affordability is reasonable. Otherwise, you just price whole younger generation out of the market, for instance, and you force so many other people to take the road to debt slavery. And what that does is uses these people at the bottom of the financial food chain to prop up the global credit Ponzi. They are being victimized in the process of forcing them into taking on debt in order to be able to exist at all. Now, I do think we'll see some attempts to prop things up in Canada, but because our housing bubble is only going over the edge now, at the point where we're about to also see a major slide in terms of access to credit, I think our slide is likely to actually be faster than what has happened in the US, because I think the circumstances of credit tightening are going to be significantly sharper. And once you deprive people of access to credit to buy properties, then you just undercut price support drastically, because your pool of buyers ends up being people who can buy in cash. And that's a very small group of people, because Chinese demand is falling over the edge as well now. And there's nothing the Canadian government can do to prop up Chinese demand for houses in Vancouver, because the Chinese bubble is bursting. That's going to suck even more liquidity out of the property market. And that liquidity could go very quickly, because that's pure speculative purchasing. These people from mainland China who don't even plan to live here are buying property because they feel it can only ever go up. That's the definition of a bubble. But that kind of demand is extremely ephemeral. I think that's going to disappear very abruptly. So when you undercut price support because you remove the major component of the demand and you remove people's ability to access credit, then the property price fall here could actually be really quite rapid.
Yeah, and it's incredible to see the change over the last few months as China's stock markets have suffered so much and mainland China economies just suffered so much. But you see for sale signs just going up unbelievably. You know, in the last few weeks, I've seen for sale signs here in Vancouver go up dramatically. And like you're saying, it prices a whole generation out of the market. For the last decade or so, there's been a massive brain drain from Vancouver as people grow up, you know, maybe go to University of British Columbia and then say, I can't afford to live in this city. I'm getting out of here. And that's kind of stacked itself up. And the Canadian dynamic's different from other countries because we have the CMHC here. Maybe you can explain a little bit about the CMHC and how that works, because I saw just recently they were reaching the limit of mortgages that they can back.
Yes, well, CMHC, Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation, is very much like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So what it is a public backstop on mortgages, which encourages the private sector to continue to make loans because there are backstops, there are guarantees. But I don't think those guarantees are going to be worth the paper they're written on. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the States are also absolutely loaded down with bad debt that they're meant to be guaranteeing. And just because there's a promise that this debt is guaranteed does not mean at all that that promise will be kept when push comes to shove. We are basically living in a giant tower of promises that cannot be kept on a whole range of fronts in terms of mortgage and loan guarantees, but also things like pension payouts and government benefits of all kinds. things. So I think many, many promises are going to be reneged on in the next few years. People are going to find that CDIC guarantees of their bank deposits aren't going to be worth anything either. This is going to cause a major, major problem when people's faith in promises is shaken to the core. That's exactly what's coming. When people realize they can't rely on these promises anymore, that's when your wily coyote, you've already run off the cliff, but you haven't looked down yet. And then all of a sudden you look down, and that's when everything gets really dramatically different. And I'm not surprised you're starting to see forests of for sale signs. That's exactly how it starts. And we can expect to see that dynamic continue. What happens is you shift very rapidly, almost overnight, into a buyer's market. And then instead of just simply throwing money at properties, often sight unseen, people will start to get very picky, and they'll start to really look at what it is they're buying. And if it's not structurally sound, they will negotiate the price down, or they'll insist that improvements will be made. What we saw in the States was people trying to shift houses by throwing in a free pickup truck if you buy the house. So the house appears to go for more money than it actually does, because the seller is actually having to put up an enormous amount, effectively, of the purchasing price by having to do something like buying a free pickup truck to give to the buyer. You end up having to come up with a lot of incentives for buyers to choose your property as opposed to somebody else's when there's a lot more on the market. And that psychological shift is so rapid. And that's really what we're seeing. So the really rapid part is the liquidity goes out of the housing market very, very quickly. Then you're in a whole different ballgame. The longer term part is for prices to actually start to come down, for sellers to start to accept lower prices, and then you reprice whole neighborhoods. This is where you get the ratcheting down. I think it's going to be a relatively rapid process, but because you have this illiquidity feature that's always part of a housing market collapse, prices don't fall overnight. The liquidity goes overnight, but prices come down a little bit more slowly. So I am still expecting the bubble to take years to deflate, but once the process has begun, people can find themselves stuck, because that whole shift from liquidity, extreme liquidity, in fact, to extreme illiquidity, that can happen almost overnight.
That's fascinating how just people's mindsets can change a whole market. I mean, we see that in stocks as well. You know, people start buying and selling just as at the drop of a hat. A rumor goes around that this company is going down, and everyone just sells off. And that sounds a little bit like what you're talking about with the housing market. I was wondering if you could walk us through a little bit about what's going to, how this kind of collapse, not just in the housing market, but economy-wise would go in, say, Canada or United States. What are the steps that happen? And then what does it look like in a post-collapse world? We had a mini collapse in 2008. Is it going to be looking similar to that? Are we going to see high gas prices, people out of work? What can we look forward to?
It's going to be worse than 2008, because we're going to see a lot more severe effect on in terms of credit crunch. So we're going to be looking at a much larger removal of credit from the system, which will undercut price support an awful lot more. I think there's going to be a major difference from 2008 in terms of, I don't think we're going to be seeing high gas prices. One aspect of what we saw in 2008 was an enormous crescendoing of the oil price and then a crash. I think we are going to see another crash of energy prices, partly because this time Chinese demand is going to be falling. As the Chinese bubble bursts, China has been propping up commodity demand and therefore commodity prices for years. It's been a really, really major player. So as the bubble bursts there, we're going to see a large fall away in demand for commodities. And that's going to feed the falling demand from contracting economies in the developed world as well. So the way a commodity bubble bursts is you have in the run-up, when you're having commodity prices being bid up, there's a perception of scarcity. People therefore bid up the price in advance of what the fundamentals would justify. So you get a bubble in commodities. We saw it in 2008. We've seen it again more recently. And then when the shift comes, when that psychological shift comes from a perception of scarcity to that perception disappearing, people will take profits. They will short the sector. And then the prices fall very sharply. That's phase one of a commodity burst. What happens after that is demand starts to fall. So demand falling simply takes an awful lot longer than the psychological shift from perception of scarcity to no perception of scarcity. So the demand fall feeds into a price fall that was already underway. And that demand fall just continues, undercutting price support. So I think we're actually going to see commodity prices come down a long way. Prices are going to be falling, unlike they were in earlier 2008, but we're not necessarily going to see things be cheap, because if credit is going away and unemployment is going to be rising, just because prices come down does not mean things are affordable, because purchasing power falls faster than price. And that's going to be a major factor going forward. Not for everyone at the same rate. It depends how many people have lost their jobs. What happens is more and more people go over the edge. They fall off the back of the bus, if you like. They lose jobs. They hit a wall. They're maxed out. They can't borrow anymore. They can't keep up with the cost of living. What really is the driver is when a critical mass of people have fallen off the back of the bus, and then you really start to see demand falling very sharply. That's also when you get the perception that this new dynamic shift has happened. When you only have some people falling off the back of the bus and enough people are still employed, still being able to keep up with the payments, then you don't have this perception that things have changed and things are now going in a dangerous direction. It really takes reaching a critical mass. So you reach a kind of point of recognition that your trend has changed, and then it will pick up momentum to the downside and it becomes more of a self-fulfilling prophecy. So these are large swings of positive feedback. In the early stages, they pick up momentum very slowly because there isn't a general perception that the trend has changed. The psychological shift is there, but it's subtle in the early stages. So you don't really get a widespread initial perception that the trend has changed. Once you hit a kind of point of recognition or a critical mass, you do get that generalized perception that the trend has changed, and then it will feed on itself and pick up momentum to the downside. So I think we're going to see a worse impact than 2008 in a number of ways. Much less credit, much more unemployment, more problems in a larger number of parts of the world than we saw in 2008. So for instance, Canada wasn't really very badly affected at all in 2008. We only started to see problems about 6 months before the rally that began in early 2009. So we hardly experienced anything more than a vague dip, unlike places like the United States, for instance, that was in the grip of the subprime crisis at the time. The impact on them in 2008 was much more significant. We had a kind of glancing blow or a shot across the bow at most, and then everyone went back to sleep again almost immediately once the rally began in March 2009. This time, I think Canada will be much harder hit. So we're looking at the fall off in commodity demand. We are a commodity economy as well as a manufacturing economy. The commodity demand from China will fall. The demand for our manufacturers from the States will fall. And they buy 80% of what we produce. And when that demand starts to go away for our manufacturers, we're going to find that we're very, very squeezed. I think that's going to push down the value of the Canadian dollar. So we're going to be finding that our imports are more expensive, and that there are going to be significant problems down the line for Canada, that they're going to be very much more significant, than much harder to take than we saw before. In 2008 was next to nothing. This is going to be the beginning of where we find out what a credit crunch really means.
Maybe some of our listeners have been seeing a financial crash in the cards for a while, have been seeing all the issues because maybe they were aware of peak oil or energy issues. But do you find that there's a lot of general misunderstandings about financial collapse and what people think about when they're starting to actually plan for it?
Absolutely. Basically, economics bears no resemblance to reality at all, neoclassical economics. So people are fed an understanding of the system that is completely and utterly wrong. Its foundations are built on sand. The assumptions that go into economics bear no resemblance to reality. And people are taught all the way through the education system, to the extent they're taught anything about economics at all, more than pure propaganda, everything they're taught is wrong. So they really have no understanding whatsoever of the real nature of the crisis and why the crisis is going to play out the way that it is. So there tends to be a perception that we're facing horrendous inflation, that governments are going to print money, that prices are going to go through the roof, and everything is going to get on that inflationary spiral, a wage price spiral. And that is absolutely so far away from the way this is going to play out. It's ridiculous. Governments are not printing money. They're trying to midwife credit. And as we discussed, that isn't going to work anymore. So we are not looking at an enormous expansion of the money supply. We're looking at a contraction. And prices are not going to rise when the money supply is falling, because contraction of the money supply will undercut price support. So prices are going to fall, not rise. The price rises we have seen over the last few years are a lagging effect of the inflation, the monetary inflation we saw before. That monetary inflation topped out in 2008, but we're still seeing prices rise as a lagging effect of people having had more purchasing power in their pockets. And also that to some extent during the rally, there was a resurgence of that effect. So it's the lagging effect of the reflation we saw during the rally as well that has continued to give us relative price support. But now that we're moving into contraction again, and we're on the verge of a very sharp contraction this time, now we're going to be seeing prices fall. But because price movements lag changes in the money supply, prices won't fall immediately. Prices will fall over time, following the money supply down, following down with the contraction in the money supply. So we're going to see prices come down, but we're going to see the disappearance primarily of credit. So the credit is the vast majority of the money supply. As credit starts to disappear, that's going to take a lot of money of the money supply away. We're going to realize there's actually not very much cash in the system at all. And when we're reduced to having only what little cash there is because the credit has gone away, then we'll realize that hardly anybody actually has any. So it's going to be a major wake-up call that we're going to see there's very, very little money in the system. And what money there is in the system is not going to be circulating in the economy, because people are going to stop spending when they don't know where their next paycheck is coming from. So we're going to start to see an economic seizure. We're going to see a collapse in the velocity of money, which means the rate at which money circulates in the economy. And money is the lubricant in the engine of the economy in the way that motor oil is the lubricant in the engine of your car. So when you try and run any kind of engine without enough liquidity, without enough lubricant, it is going to seize up on you. That is what we are facing. And almost nobody understands that at all. It's going to be a rerun of the 1930s, only worse. But because the 1930s are on the verge of moving out of living memory, and for most of us, they occurred long before we were born, we do not have a sense of how depressions genuinely play out. Our memories are more of inflationary times, so we naturally think in terms of crisis equals more of what we've already had. We're just extrapolating past trends into the future and thinking, well, if we continue to do this, we might be in trouble. But what we are actually going to see is not a continuation of the past trend. We are going to see a very sharp trend reversal, and we're going to see things go very rapidly in the opposite direction, with a contraction of the money supply and falling prices, but things getting less affordable because purchasing power is falling faster than price. Almost nobody understands that dynamic or understands why it's absolutely inevitable that it will play out that way. So what I'm really trying to do is to teach ordinary people how finance works, how the system actually functions and what we are facing, so that they can try and navigate a very, very difficult future. And what I'm trying to do in explaining finance to ordinary people is to keep more of the resources that will come out of a collapsing Ponzi scheme at the base of the wealth pyramid. Because otherwise, if ordinary people do not understand how the system works, whatever comes out of a collapsing Ponzi scheme will end up either disappearing in a black hole of credit destruction or disappearing into the back pockets of bankers and the very well-connected. Ordinary people are hardly going to get a look in at all. By trying to explain to ordinary people how the system works so that they can get hold of what assets they have and protect those assets while there's still time to do so, that will keep wealth at the bottom of the financial food chain in the hands of people who will do something genuinely useful with it. That, I think, is extremely important. Now, it's also unfair in a lot of ways.
I'm sorry, why is it important to keep it at the bottom? Why is that important for us?
Because it's decentralized initiatives, community-based grassroots initiatives that will really be the future, that have the best chance of getting us through the coming bottleneck. They have to be funded somehow. So if there's no wealth at the grassroots, none at all, it's all been sucked up to the center, then that will put a very hard limit on what kind of decentralization initiatives can really get off the ground. I am trying to put money in the hands of people at the grassroots in order that they have the capacity to fund these initiatives. Now, it's going to be sort of messy and unfair because a few people will end up with the ability to protect their assets. Few people will be able to hang on to their assets and other people won't. So there'll be a major change in who has money and who doesn't. But I tell people, if you do manage to preserve your assets, to get hold of them out of a collapsing Ponzi scheme, do not think, I'm all right, Jack, and sit on those assets and just expect to enjoy the benefits of them yourself, because if you do that, you've just painted a giant target on your forehead. What you need to do is to regard those assets as then a community responsibility. So if you have more, you have the responsibility to do more on behalf of your community, very much including pooling resources and funding community initiatives. Now, other people have a lot to bring to the table. The people who don't have any money will have time or skills or enthusiasm or infrastructure that they can share or something. People who have money have only one component of what needs to be shared, but it is an important component. So in trying to keep money at the base of the pyramid, I'm trying to set up the potential for that wealth to be shared within the community. However, that will depend on the individuals who have control of the money, trying to convince them that it's in their interests to look after others, because there is no better guarantor of your security than having your survival be in other people's interests.
So the Alex Jones mindset of having gold, having guns, having your wealth all in a bunker down underneath your house is the wrong way to go about it then.
Oh, yes. I mean, basically, if you just try and isolate yourself with a whole pile of gold and guns and ammo, you've created a gilded prison, but it's absolutely a prison, whether it's gilded or not. And then you won't be able to sleep at night. You know, if you're in a remote location, how will you go to sleep unless there are an awful lot of people around to take turns with the guns? If you're in a gated community, for instance, how are you going to go to sleep when you never know if someone's going to outbid you for the services of the security guard on the gate and let someone in who's then going to take everything you have? So I think that whole, you know, isolate yourself and sit on your pile of wealth is a terrible way to go about it. You make yourself a target. I mean, we see this in places like South Africa, for instance, enormous walls to keep people out, but a horrendous crime rate. And when people do get in beyond those walls, it tends to go extremely badly for the people who were living there, because the people who broke in take great delight in harming, not just stealing from the people behind the gates, but actively harming them as well. So I think people who take that route are making themselves extremely vulnerable in ways perhaps they don't quite appreciate. I think it's far better to say there's strength in numbers, there's strength and capacity to deal with hard times in community. And yes, there is a place in some ways for the Second Amendment approach to things. Sometimes you do need to be able to protect what you have with weaponry, but I would rather that was considered a very secondary approach. I would rather people fought in terms of primarily strength in numbers and looking after each other. And then there are all kinds of other passive safety features, like, for instance, window shutters or keeping a dog or having a gate or motion-sensitive lighting and things like that. We do need to protect what we have. There will be people whose strategy is to take from those who did, because they either didn't have anything themselves to protect, or they just didn't bother to protect it in time, and they're going around trying to take things from others. I do think we have to be aware that that is going to happen and take steps to protect what we have, but the best protection we can possibly have is each other, and that, I think, is fundamentally more constructive.
If someone's listening and wants to start assessing their vulnerability, what's the first steps they can start taking towards doing that?
Well, to think through, what are they dependent upon? So if they continue to live in whatever place they're living in, what do they have to have in order for that place to be habitable or to be useful? So are they dependent on a car, or are there buses, or can they walk? If they're in an apartment building and they're above the third floor, well, they're dependent on electricity to pump water up there. Without electricity supplies, there will be no water in that apartment above above approximately the third floor. So those are things that they can think about. Or when you look at how vulnerable you are in terms of debt, it's what amount of money do I have to be making every month in order to continue to service this debt? What would happen if the interest rates went up? What kind of capacity do I have to service debt at a higher rate of interest? Because most people don't realize how vulnerable they are to an incredibly small rise in interest rates, when it's not a small rise we're facing, it's a large one. So people need to think about vulnerabilities like that. Now, if you think through those vulnerabilities, you can reduce some of them. And if you realize that you're acutely vulnerable to a small rise in interest rates, for instance, if it's a property that you are indebted on, then sell the property and get out from under the debt. If it's credit card debt, then make every effort to pay that down so that you're not constantly on the hook for horrendous payments. So in financial terms, it's things like debt, but in terms of the physical structure of where we live, it's could we live without access to gas? Could we live without access to electricity? What happens if the people who run the water system stop being able to afford to put chlorine in the water supply, and then we end up with sewage contamination or something like that? So think through what ways you might be able to insulate yourself from some of those eventualities. In the case of the water system, for instance, you can have a water filter, run all the water through a filtration system. Aid agencies use these in the third world, where you can drink out of puddles full of goat droppings and still not get sick. So if you run things through a decent filtration system, that's one less thing you have to worry about, the quality of your water. I'm not suggesting that water won't come out of the tap, but I do think it's possible over time that what comes out of the tap might not be particularly healthful. So you can take the health maintaining aspect of that into your own hands by preparing in advance.
In the case of Vancouver, for our water purification, there's trucks that deliver chlorine, and there was an occasion a few years ago, because of heavy flooding, that part of the road was blocked, and there were some serious concerns that the trucks that bring the chlorine in would have very limited access, and it was just a few days away from not having enough chlorine to put into the water supply. So that can happen very quickly.
And also, there are many things, water treatment being one of them, there are many others as well, that simply are quite sophisticated processes that require a lot of coordination and for a lot of things to continue to go right. And it doesn't take more than one of those things not to go right before your coordinated, carefully sorted out system doesn't deliver what it's meant to deliver anymore. So, for instance, what we saw in Walkerton, Ontario, was a contamination of the water supply because the people who were running it simply hadn't got their act together. People not getting their act together is a major part of what happens in contraction. People are worried about other things, so they don't necessarily do their job properly. So we can start worrying about airline safety and things like that, or nuclear safety. These are all things that require a tremendous amount of coordination. I mean, I remember another instance of water contamination from Camelford, Cornwall, where a trucker had accidentally put a waste product in the wrong tank so that it went into the drinking water supply rather than the waste system, and it caused neurological damage for thousands of people. So there are a whole lot of things that can happen that can have major effects. And at Walkerton, I think several thousand people were ill and several people died of E. coli poisoning. So we do have to think about what we are dependent on. Water is a huge one. I mean, when you have water systems go wrong, you can get cholera and all sorts of epidemics. So we can take some simple steps to try to protect ourselves against vulnerabilities like unclean water. We can take other steps to protect ourselves against sporadic power supplies. So for instance, if we know our basement is going to flood if the sump pump doesn't work, well, we can put in a battery backup, and then we don't end up with the foundations of our home being undermined by flooding in ways that could actually mean that the home is no longer structurally sound. So there are relatively minor things that can make a really big difference to insulating ourselves against certain vulnerabilities.
You mentioned before that we need to take that wealth that we have as individuals and are going to need to share it. For people that have, you know, 401ks or, you know, large amounts of money invested in mutual funds or bonds or stocks or something in that nature, should they keep the money in those places, or should they be moving it towards, you know, like gold, or should they be moving it towards, just like you say, improvements of their house or buying water filtration systems? Is it a move away from these financial instruments that should be happening instead, or, you know, should we have a whole bunch of money under our mattress? but where should the money be living?
Well, money that is in the grip of the system is at risk because the vast majority of it is excess claims to underlying real wealth. The collateral at the base of the system has been drastically overpledged against gargantuan quantities of debt. Most financial assets are nothing more than an obligation to pay someone something, and that is going to turn out to be promises that can't be kept. So I'm definitely telling people that whatever you have in the grip of the system, whether it's in a bank account, a brokerage account, your mutual funds, pension funds, this is money that is at risk, and the risk is growing sharply over time. As we saw with MF Global, the collapse of MF Global was from one day to the next, and the customer's money was simply gone, and they're never going to see it back again. So if you're, what you have is caught up in the system, it is subject to very rapid disappearance. It simply goes poof in the night, or it can do. And so that is a major catastrophic level of risk. What I tell people to do is to try and have the most control they possibly can over what they have. So that will mean money, real cash under their own control, be way more creative than mattresses. That's far too obvious, but people will simply have to be creative with whatever creative potential their own circumstances allow. So you do need a certain amount of actual access to cash. You know, if ATMs stop working or no longer dispensing anything, you had better have some money on hand or you're going to be in trouble really very quickly. So it doesn't have to be an enormous amount, but whatever you can manage. I tell people if you can, a few months worth, a year's worth. I realize that that's very much easier said than done. And there are an awful lot of people who couldn't possibly do that.
That's like several thousand dollars, right? Like a couple hundred, maybe $10,000?
Yeah, I mean, it depends how much a few months to a year's worth of cash would be for you individually. Some people's expenditures are a lot more than others. But I would say if you can at least manage to put aside, you know, even if you haven't got very much, if you can manage to put aside a week's worth, it's better than nothing. No, and then try and, of course, if you actually have to use it, to spin it out as long as you possibly can. Basically, anything you can put aside will be a cushion against money not being available in the system anymore. And that can be very, very important. The other thing, as we've discussed, is hard goods like water filters or wind-up radio or solar cookers. And if people have enough to be able to get out of debt and hold a certain amount of cash and buy hard goods, then that's absolutely great. That's the best kind of insulation against general economic upheaval that you can have. Now, some things like the hard goods I just mentioned are not actually terribly expensive anyway. So a lot of people could afford to do that, and they might be able to buy themselves out of a lot of vulnerability at relatively little expense. So hard goods like that are very much worth buying up front. The prices may fall over time, but on the other hand, they may not be available at any price. Right now, you can get things like a solar cooker that's made by the Amish with the internet and a credit card with no trouble whatsoever. But if you lose access to either the internet or a credit card or both, good luck getting something that's Amish made in Ohio. So we don't make them in our own areas, and then we are out of luck. The same goes with water filters. So certain things it is worth getting hold of up front. Other things, like say a farm, if that's where your inclinations take you, it's the rare person who can buy a farm with no debt. So you would have to wait for prices to fall before you would think in terms of putting money into something like that. It's important to do it with no debt, because if you buy something on margin with debt, you're simply going to lose it. Somebody's going to foreclose on it. So it's not worth making investments with borrowed money. The odds are that you simply end up losing whatever it is that you bought. Unless, of course, you can run away with it out of the country or something like that. There may be some things that fall under those circumstances. But it's criminal for one thing. And I certainly wouldn't encourage anything along those lines. I think there are so many genuinely constructive things that we can do that we really do not have to think in terms of gaming the system in ways that cause negative impact on other people needlessly. So, I mean, there are always going to be ways to protect yourself that are not very advisable. I think we need to stick with the ones that are advisable, because there are plenty of those to be going on with.
Did you do really well in a first or second year course? Want to make a difference in the UBC community and school communities around the world? Join Students Offering Support, or SOS, and become a tutor today. Math, accounting, economics, psychology, engineering courses, French and Spanish, statistics, and more. If you aced it, Students Offering Support wants you to help other students ace it too. Check out UBCStudentsOfferingSupport.com for more information.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. Today we're talking with Nicole Foss of The Automatic Earth. How would you go about talking about these ideas to people who don't really understand them so much, or, you know, say someone like we were talking about our parents before? How do you bring up ideas that are so, I mean, these ideas are pretty far outside of people's normal thought processes. You don't see them on TV. You don't really see them in media. How do you go about bringing these ideas up to people who have been a part of the system for their whole lives, who have been indoctrinated in the capitalistic way of thinking, and they have no doubt that in, you know, 10 years they're going to be able to retire on their large 401ks. How do you do that?
Well, you raise an interesting point. The first part of your question was, how do you explain these ideas to people who don't know anything about it? And then the second part was, how do you explain it to people who think they know something about it, but what they know is wrong? It's actually much easier to explain it to the former group of people. So I find it's a lot easier to explain these ideas to, say, high school students or university students who've never studied economics and therefore don't have any blinders, who have no prior information, no prejudices, nothing standing in the way that they would have to unlearn before they can learn how the world really works. Explaining the ideas to them is not hard at all. Explaining it to people who think they know but are mistaken is very much more difficult. So it really is a question of having to work on undermining the worldview in the sense of asking them to challenge their assumptions, to think through the assumptions that their view is based on. And you probably have to do that with one assumption at a time. And eventually the idea is to get them to the point where they realize that every one of the assumptions they've built their worldview on is fundamentally mistaken. At that point, perhaps you can try to substitute a different worldview or show them how assumptions that are actually grounded in reality lead to a very different worldview. So it's not that you have to impose ideas on people, but you have to give them the tools to come to the right conclusions. And that really is the way to tackle it. It won't work with everybody, though.
It's so hard to do.
It's very, very difficult to convince people who have a very entrenched mindset, who have a lot to lose. But in some ways, the more they have to lose, the more they cling to the system that gave them what they had, because that's all they know and it's what they benefited from. And they can't conceive of a different future. So they stay blinkered and stuck in the system. And the risk is they will lose everything.
Being, you know, in our mid, early 20s, or maybe just finishing up a university degree, how is preparing for all of this different than perhaps how our parents would prepare?
Well, basically, the older generation, because they typically have a lot of assets to look after, it'll be about trying to preserve capital. And how do you do that? Well, you preserve capital as liquidity largely. But for young people, they don't have access to assets. And some of them are also carrying a fair amount of debt. I would say if there's any way to get out of debt, then by all means do so, even if it means you have to live on a shoestring and not be able to do a lot of the things that one's friends would take for granted. Trying to get out of debt means that nobody has a sword of Damocles over your head. Nobody owns your life. If you're already not in debt, then you're a long way ahead of the curve. And it's a question of staying that way and then thinking how you could develop your abilities in order to provide essential goods or services without having to get into debt to do it. So think through what your abilities are and how you could develop those in ways that don't cost a lot of money. So you're not having to take out huge amounts of student loans or jump through hoops just to be able to tick a box to say, I am now qualified to do this. There are quite a lot of skills that one can develop that don't involve getting involved in that whole box-ticking, hoop-jumping paradigm that's really all about using young people as engines of credit expansion, treating them as the next generation of debt slaves, which is a horrible thing to do to the younger generation. And that's exactly what we have been doing for a very long time. So for younger people, it's a question of staying out of the trap while trying to imagine how you could be useful in the future. Because if you can be useful, you will still be able to put food on the table. I think we also, however, need to bring the generations together, because a lot of the time, it's going to be a question of putting together the assets of the older generation with with the physical abilities of the younger generation. So the older generation, they have generally little debt and lots of assets, but their pensions are going to disappear. Their health care coverage is going to go away at the very time they would need to rely on it. So they have their own vulnerabilities. The younger generation has not much assets and a lot of debt, but they have their youth and they have their health. And if you put those two halves together, then you create something that is very much more robust as a structure than either side could ever hope to be on its own. The state supports and the external supports that we've become accustomed to are going away. We are not going to have them. So we're going to have to look after ourselves at an individual level, at a family level, at a community level, all simultaneously, of course. But the more connections, the more interdependence we can build, the more pooling of resources we can do, the better off all of us will be.
The Great Depression played out over a very long period of time. And so I was wondering if you could give us some insights into what it was like to live during the Great Depression. And what did people do to support themselves for jobs, for money? And are there any things that we could do in the future to support ourselves to earn money or valuable skills that we could have?
It was very, very difficult in the 1930s. So you would have, say, groups of men standing on a street corner waiting to see if a truck would pull up and pick a few of them to go off to work at the docks or something like that. You know, this was difficult. On any given day, a few of them would get some work and be able to earn some money. Other people would have to go back home again. And there were certain payments that were available, some relief programs, but they weren't really enough to live on. People were having to, you know, not be able to heat their homes, not be able to feed their children. It was really, really difficult for a very long period of time. There are pictures of well-dressed men in suits wandering through the streets with a sandwich board saying, "We'll work for food," and things. People were just desperate, and they had a lot of pride. They didn't want to take handouts. They wanted to work for a living. These days, I think we're an awful lot more comfortable with handouts than people were back then. We have less pride in self-sufficiency, which is somewhat sad. So I don't know to what extent we will try and be as proactive as they did then in trying to look for things. I think when we get desperate enough, we will be proactive and we will be out there trying to look for anything that we can do to earn a living. And it's not going to be what we would necessarily want to be doing. We're going to find, an awful lot of us are going to find, we are forced to do whatever is available that will pay. And when there's a large amount of unemployment, people have no bargaining power, either individually or collectively. That makes life so much harder for everyone. If you've read The Grapes of Wrath, for instance, when an enormous number of people had been driven off their land on the plains and ended up in California expecting to pick fruit, because there were so many of them, they were absolutely exploited to the nth degree by the people who ran the farms in California. They were paid less than living wages, even although what they needed to live on was incredibly modest. They were just being exploited and used. And this was a horrible dynamic, but I think we are going to live through that kind of period again, where the balance of power is going to shift because unemployment will be high. The few people who still have money and who have the capacity to employ others are going to have a lot of power over the lives of those others. So I think we're going to be looking at more kind of Dickensian working conditions, which is absolutely tragic. And I very much hope that people don't think that because I'm predicting this, that somehow this is what I want to have happen. Absolutely not. I think it's ghastly, but I think it's very much where the dynamic that is unfolding is unfortunately going to be taking us. And you're right that the Depression lasted a long time. The initial collapse, the deleveraging, occurred from 1929 to 1933. That was the stock market collapse. The world of finance is a leading indicator. The real economy follows behind. So the Depression lasted for years and years beyond the point where the stock market was starting to recover again. And I think we're going to see the same thing again. I think we're going to see a very long period of economic depression. And this is going to be something that has to be endured. It doesn't mean it will always be equally bad, however. I mean, one thing we saw in the 1930s was a reflation between 33 and 37 that did improve conditions somewhat. And then you had a secondary collapse from 37 to 42, and things got very difficult again. And in a way, it was that second collapse where people just started to lose it, because they'd lived through the first collapse, things had started to look up again, they were just starting to get to the point where people thought, finally, it's over, things are getting better. The rug was pulled out from under their feet a second time, and that's when you started to get the major problems with people just becoming very angry. That's where you started to get public support for conflict, for instance. So the impetus to go to war tends to come out of that second rug pulling out from under the feet episode. We may well live through something similar. Or you could, in fact, argue that the reflation from 2003 to 2007 following the tech wreck was our period where we thought things were getting back to normal. Or on a smaller scale, we could say the reflation from March 2009 to 2011 was our feeling that we were getting back to normal again. So these things work on different degrees of trend. You can look at a reflation reigniting the hopes of the masses at different scales simultaneously, but having had our hopes reignited, when the rug is pulled out from under our feet again, that tends to be when people get very angry. So we could find that the gap between the fall this time and the impetus to go to war is a lot shorter than one might expect. And I think that is, again, a terrible dynamic, but it is predictable that we are going to start to see more in the way of conflict, that there's going to be a blame game, a tendency to go and kick someone else to make ourselves feel better. And that is all part of the psychology of contraction, where people are angry and afraid and looking for scapegoats. And it is part of the tragedy of our times.
So as we see this rug being slowly pulled out from under us, we've seen it for a number of years now, and people's dreams are slowly, you know, eroding, and the debt is just mounting. Should people feel hopeful that there is a future ahead of them? Should people feel that there is something that they can do to make this better? Is there something that you feel that as this all unravels and as all your predictions start to come true, is there that hope within you that people and humans will survive?
The hope relies on getting our expectations in line with reality so that we know the scope of what is physically possible and get ourselves into a mindset where we're prepared to live within what is realistic. That is going to be step number one. If we can do that, then there's a lot we can do. And yes, I do have hope that people will get their act together and will build small, simple, decentralized initiatives at a community level, that the grassroots initiatives can grow to the point where people will be able to look after themselves a little bit more and not have to be so reliant on external safety nets. I think that is the critical fact, because if we are dependent on external safety nets that are going away, if we've done nothing to look after ourselves, to build self-reliance, then we are going to be at the mercy of whatever fate has to throw at us, and we are not going to like that because it's going to be horrible. If we can build parallel structures at a community level before the centralized systems have collapsed, then we have something to fall back on. And yes, it will not look like what we are used to, not even slightly, but it will, if we do it properly, provide the basics. And if we're prepared to live with the basics, then I think there's going to be an upside to that as well. Yes, there's the downside of disappointment of having to take a giant step backwards in terms of material standard of living. But in our expansion years, when we were seeking out increases in material standard of living, we were compromising our societies because we were becoming extremely atomized. We were breaking down the ties that bind, the interdependencies, breaking down the community that ultimately is what makes people happy, that is the fundamental foundation for society. We have damaged that a lot in recent years, in recent decades, in fact. I think what we have now is the chance to rebuild community and to rediscover what it means to be human. And I think there is a tremendous amount of potential for individual fulfillment in that. Once we go back to a situation where we genuinely engage with other people, we haven't done that much. We've tended to value autonomy over civic engagement. Now we must go back to civic engagement, because autonomy will leave us high and dry. We will not be protected at all if we try to say that, no, we're an island and we can manage on our own. No man is an island. If we go back into a culture of civic engagement, there is a great deal that can be done, even without a lot of resources and without a lot of money. There's a lot that people can do if they're prepared to put in the effort that it takes to pool what resources we have. Yes, I have hope. I wouldn't do what I do if I had no hope that anything could work. I'm not telling people it will be easy. It absolutely won't. It will be very difficult, and it will be fighting an uphill battle. And decentralization initiatives will be a threat to wealth conveyance in favor of the center, which the center is addicted to. So the center will try and actively target decentralization initiatives, make them much more difficult and dangerous than they should be. But if we do this anyway, if we do decentralize, then we do have a future that is genuinely worth living. We live lifestyles that the kings and queens of old would have envied. There's a tremendous amount of scope for living with less material wealth and far more interconnected with the people who surround us. And I think that is a hopeful vision, as difficult as it will be to get there. If we do nothing, we know that we fail and we're at the mercy of fate. And that is going to be a horrible position to be in. So I think we need to do that which is within our power, recognizing it will be difficult, but go ahead and do it anyway, because this is what we can do, and this is what gives us the best hope we can possibly have.
You were a child, crawling on your knees toward it, making mom so proud, but your voice is too loud. Off the plants, the time to think of consequences. Control yourself, take only what you need from it.
And that's it for our discussion with Nicole Foss. That's the version of our interview that has been edited down for radio. We have the full conversation available on our website. And how can people find that site, Seth?
Well, Justin, people that are interested in listening to the full version of the Nicole Foss talk can check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. That is extraenvironmentalist.com. People can follow us on Facebook. They can find us on Twitter. We have a blog that's going on. That's extraenvironmentalist.com/blog. We are on Stitcher Radio, and we are on this station too, Justin.
As well as others in British Columbia. So there's many different ways that you can listen to The Extra Environmentalist. And all of our shows, we cut them down to an hour just to fit them on radio. But there's so much more available on our website that Seth was just talking about at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. So thanks for listening to The Extra Environmentalist. We will look forward to catching you next week from 2 to 3 p.m. here on CITR.